Welcome to Dr. Eileen McCabe-Moucher's Inner Peace Diet Podcast. Real solutions for an authentic and peaceful life.
Hi there, welcome to the Inner Peace Diet Podcast. My name is Dr. Eileen McCabe-Moucher and I am your host. I am a licensed psychotherapist, clinical social worker, college professor, and author of the book, The Inner Peace Diet. But most importantly, I am a human being just like you, trying my best to live a healthy and peaceful lifestyle during these chaotic and uncertain times that we find ourselves living in. So the purpose of this podcast is to bring you some authentic and effective stress management and self-care tools that you can use in your own life to reduce your stress and lead a more peaceful and joyful lifestyle. In today's Inner Peace Diet podcast, I am delighted and honored to be interviewing Dr. Mary McCluskey. Dr. McCluskey earned her master's degree in social work from Columbia School of Social Work and her doctoral degree in social work from the University of Pennsylvania School of Policy and Practice. She has been practicing clinical social work for over a decade and has certification in psychodynamic psychotherapy from the American Institute of Psychoanalysis. Dr. McCluskey has taught social work at the University of Pennsylvania, Fordham University, and Simmons College. She has also taught psychodynamic therapy at the American Institute for Psychoanalysis. Currently, she teaches social work at New York University. Dr. McCluskey recently published in a research article, The Pregnant Therapist, a Qualitative Examination of the Client Experience in the Clinical Social Work Journal. Dr. McCluskey is also in private practice in New York City. So thank you so much, Mary, for taking time out of your extremely busy schedule, especially during this holiday season, to talk about self-care, this important topic. And I'm wondering if you could get us started, Mary, just by telling us, what do you think is some of the best self-care advice that you've received that actually works to reduce your stress?
Sure. I think the best advice that I've gotten regarding self-care is to actually ask for help. Mm. And I think that I think particularly in our society, we're taught basically that we should be self-sufficient. And I think that's such a huge message that we're given, that we should be independent and self-sufficient. And I think that sometimes it creates a false scenario that we really shouldn't be asking other people for help. And I think that really takes its toll on people. And so that would be my advice is to, you know, when you are needing support, to actually ask for it. Because otherwise you're just kind of floating out there and really struggling a lot more than you need to be.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that. I think that that's, you know, such a foundational self-care skill. And it's something that, you know, we don't always do. Like you're saying, you know, in American culture, especially, there's this sense of like rugged individualism, like pull yourselves up by your bootstraps and do it all
exactly.
And that's just
exactly
not the way to be healthy. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that. Sometimes it's counterintuitive, right? We think even if we know that it's beneficial to ask for help, we can sometimes forget that that's an option. And it's so important to have that reminder, you know, that,
exactly. You know, there's, I'm not sure who coined it, but there's something, you probably heard of it, but I think it really makes sense, called the dependency paradox, where basically you're, you know, the only way to be independent in life is really to be dependent on somebody else. So it's kind of that philosophy that you can't have one without the other. And I really like that kind of dependency paradox idea, in the sense that I think it helps to really kind of give permission. I think you need to, I think people need to give themselves permission to ask for help, to not be 100% independent, because people need people.
Yes. Yeah. Really,
you know, I really
take a village.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a TED Talk that I show most of my classes by Jonathan Hari.
Says is that the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. And so his whole talk is talking about really how so many, and I completely agree with it, so many societal ills and stressors are from lack of connection and feeling isolated and that type of thing. So I think it's one of the most important things and aspects, I think, to understand is that we're not in it alone. We shouldn't be in it alone. And, you know, to build a support system in a network and to be able to call on those people for whatever you need. And I think the other piece of self-care advice is being able to set boundaries,
mm-hmm.
being able to say no, and to kind of not feel guilty about it. Or I think that there's this sense of in line with not asking for help.
Mm.
I train at a psychoanalytic institute, and the theorist whose teachings are currently taught there, she's now deceased, is Karen Horney, and she speaks about a concept which she calls tyranny of the shoulds.
So I should be this, I should do that. And basically what she's saying, and I think it just makes so much sense, and I see it all the time in my practice, is that in my life, is that people really are trying to live up to this imaginary measuring stick that really doesn't exist.
Yes.
And they're trying to be perfect. And that's not attainable. So it's a setup. And so a lot of people won't ask for help because they're saying, I should be this, I should be that. I shouldn't need help. I should be able to do this on my own. When in fact, that's not accurate. You shouldn't have to, but it becomes, I think again, because part of our culture is hardwired for us to think that, we have to kind of reframe our thinking and start thinking about, you know, we're human and we have flaws and we should embrace those flaws and, you know, and share them in the sense of, you know, trying to improve and all of those things, but to kind of know that, we need to give ourselves permission to fail once in a while and to not be perfect.
Yeah.
Because I think people do strive for perfection so much.
Absolutely. Definitely. And you know that, you know, really being vulnerable with each other, like you're saying, it's such a powerful way to connect with other people, you know, with your authentic self around vulnerabilities, you know, finding trusted people that you can connect to and ask for, ask that help.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What would you say to someone who might be, you know, reading your words or listening to you and wondering, you know, how do I go about finding or making these connections? I mean, we live in this world now where so many of us mm-hmm. spend so much time, you know, behind a computer, looking at telephones, staying connected to people in that way. Maybe what advice or words of wisdom would you say to somebody who wants to connect more deeply to other people?
That's a great question. I'm wondering if I have a great answer. It's hard. And I will start by saying one of the things that I tell a lot of people, and I, you know, follow this for myself, is that oftentimes I'll tell people to actually take a break from social media, take a break from Facebook and whatever else, other kinds of Instagram and those types of things, because I find that a lot of times it's actually more isolating than it is connecting,
mm-hmm.
because there's so many different layers of, I'm not even sure how to describe it, but I think you know what I'm getting at.
Yes.
But you know, there's a lot of sense of false relationships, or there's, you know, it's just too, there's something too impersonal about it. And I also find that, you know, and I'm constantly reminding people of this, that people really, in my experience and from what I've seen, really only post things that they want people to see. And so everybody starts comparing themselves to other people and feeling like they're not as successful, or so sometimes I find that that social media can really actually be contribute to a lot of distress. And so that's one of the advice that I give people, is to take a break from it, especially if it's really affecting them. And to really seek out kind of other ways of connecting on a more personal level. So while you may have 500 Facebook friends, there may really only be 20 on there that you really feel a connection with. And I think, for those that already have established connections, I think it's really making more of an effort to connect in different ways other than Facebook, which can be a really good way to connect. But at the same time, it can be also a very kind of shallow, and, you know, you don't have that same kind of, it's not a 45-minute phone conversation with a good friend.
Yes.
And I think that's much more, you know, that's much more important. That's when you learn what's really going on and are able to kind of connect on a different level. But I think the other, you know, the other thing I would say is, you know, it really depends on what people are interested in, and really trying to connect either via interests or commonalities, whether it's, you know, whether it's through a support group, or I don't have a lot of experience with these. I've heard of these, and I think it's a great idea, kind of meetup groups and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But really just trying to, I think one thing that anybody can absolutely do is, if they're feeling alienated and disconnected, is absolutely seek out a therapist, and work with somebody that, you know, find somebody you can trust and work with that can help you to look at your network, to look at what's going on in your life that may or may not be contributing to your feeling isolated. I would say that would be a first step in my opinion, is to, if you're not sure where to go or how to go about it, is to really connect with somebody, a professional that can really help you to navigate those for some people are really terrifying connections.
Yes.
Some people just don't know how to do it. And then they feel like there's something wrong, when in fact it's really, they just need more, they may need more support around it. And help identifying different ways of connecting with people.
Yeah. Fantastic strategies, Mary. It's awesome. Thank you. Over the years, I've had clients come to me, as I'm sure that you've had, that are really seeking this quick fix for anxiety or depression or some type of like magical cure for time poverty. And, you know, mm-hmm. if I'm honest with myself, I'll look at a lot of my education, particularly continuing education. And as I look at those records, I've been in search of that, you know, not only for myself, but for the clients that I serve. You know, what's the fastest way that we can get somebody on a path to healing? And I've learned that it often takes a lifetime, if not several years, of dedicated practice and hard work and intention to be able to get on that healing path. But all that said, what do you think is the closest thing to a quick fix for stress that actually works?
Yeah, I struggled with this one. I think it's certainly quick fixes have to be the little things that add up. So things that you can check off that are hard for you maybe to do. One example for me is time poverty. I'm always running out of time, and I overcommit a lot of times. And then I'm running around, and I notice that I forgot to eat, and that's such a basic thing, but it happens. It's happened so much. But I have started to kind of practice making sure that I actually pack myself some kind of sustenance, that because I get, you know, I get cranky when I don't eat, or I get tired, and I like anybody will run out of energy, but I honestly will forget to eat. So I think something as basic as having something for yourself that you're doing for yourself like that, that you normally don't necessarily think to do. And I know it sounds, it's so basic, but it's really, it's so important. The other I mentioned before was take a break. If you're feeling anxious and depressed, take a break from social media, because most people aren't up there having a kind of depression talks necessary, you know? And so I think it just really, can really be helpful to get uninvolved, less involved in other people's lives, and more kind of involved in yourself and in your own kind of self healing and awareness. And I don't know that there's any quick strategy, and I'm asked it all the time as well. But you know, one of the things I do is ask, you know, and I think this is taught in social work school, but what has worked for you in the past, mm-hmm. you know, and trying to capitalize on what has, I mean, because oftentimes almost all the time, the solution is within the person, yes. You know, what makes you feel good. And it is probably going to be something completely different than what I might recommend, because people are so unique and different, and everybody has a different, you know, feelings about what's relaxing or de-stressing for them. For some people, it's physical exercise. For other people, it's reading a book or, you know, doing something of more of an intellectual pursuit. But I think it's trying to really find out from people what's helped in the past too, and what are your triggers? You know, yes. what makes you feel more stressed out, and what makes you feel more anxious or depressed? And they're not always going to have an answer to that, but I think oftentimes people will say, very well intentionally, you know, you'll be talking to a friend and saying how stressed out you are, and they're kind of telling you what they would do. Mm-hmm. Like they would go shopping. But for me, that wouldn't be helpful, because then I would be stressed about, you know, spending too much money, or that's just not something for me that makes me feel better. But yes. For some people, it's helpful. So it's really understanding what it is and helping the person to identify what it is that makes them. And I don't think there's a quick fix to figuring that out necessarily. But for some people, I think you can tap into that. I think for a lot of people, I speak to a lot of people who find yoga to be very helpful. And they know that right away. But that's one of the things that they go to right away is yoga or meditation. I hear that over and over again. But for some people, it's not going to be the right answer.
Exactly.
So it really is getting to know yourself, your triggers, and how you can minimize kind of the triggers and tolerate more. But again, I think that's more a long-term. You're also talking to kind of more of a psychodynamic therapist, and mm-hmm. So I see things a little bit more happening on a long-term, deeper level.
Yes.
So I'm not maybe the best person to ask about quick fixes.
Yes. I think it's great. And you've said so many wonderful things there, Mary, so many important things that can actually help people. I love how you talk about, you know, helping people really tap into their own internal and unique wisdom, you know, versus on sort of relying on external advice that may work for one person, but not work for another.
Right. And I actually also think that another important thing that I've certainly learned in my practice is that And in my training, really, from a lot of very wise clinicians, is that, you know, it's very easy for an outside person to tell somebody to stop doing something. So if somebody is coping by drinking, it's easy for an outside person to say, stop drinking, right? Because that seems like that would be the answer. And that would be the quick fix. We all know it's not that easy to do. But I think the thing that I wanted to kind of highlight is not that. I think that what we have defenses for a reason. They've kept us, you know, safe, and, you know, people cope in different ways. And what we need to, I think, do is to not take away somebody's coping, but to replace it with healthier.
Yes.
With something that feels healthier, and to be able to help somebody identify, well, I don't want to drink so much. So what are some other things, you know, that could replace that in kind of a coping type of way that might be healthier? And just trying to really identify those things on a very personal level.
Yes. Yeah. I'm so glad that you said that, Mary. You know, I was trained in Gestalt therapy. I went to a 3-year program at the Gestalt Institute of Philadelphia, and so many fantastic teachers there, and virtually all of them were psychoanalytically trained prior to coming to Gestalt. And they used a lot of books, methods and ways of thinking in their treatment of clients. And one of the things that Philip Lichtenberg would say is, he would say, you know, when you're working with a client, because it was always my instinct to rush in and fix as a young therapist, and now even as an older one, it's like, that's right. Really, it's a something that I'm constantly aware of, that I'm not serving someone necessarily by rushing in and offering fixes and solutions before I really connect with them and help them learn how to connect with themselves. But Philip would always say, you know, we don't want to go in. Just like in the same way that if you see a fence around something in a yard, you're not going to just like rush around and take down the fence unless you know why it's there or why somebody put it up in the first place. So it's something I have to constantly remind myself about, you know, when I'm working with someone. And you just said that so beautifully. You illustrated the importance of, you know, respecting those defenses, you know, not even with clients, but with yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Knowing, know thyself. I mean, that would be the most, I think for me, as far as self-care goes, I think that's really the most important thing that one can do.
Yeah.
Is know your strengths, your limitations, and embrace them in a way that works for you. And on my website, I have a quote is from an author. His name is Ted Rubin. He used to be the president of my institute. And he writes that the antidote to self-hate is compassion for oneself. So it's learning how to be compassionate about who you are and what you might feel are flaws, or just not, you know, you may not live up to your expectations. But I just really like that concept. And I actually recommend that book to some of my clients when I find it, you know, appropriate. But it's called Compassion and Self-Hate. And it just really talks about how we need to learn to know ourselves better in a way that's more accepting.
Yes. Yeah. Awesome, Mary. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
When you think about self-care, I actually don't remember the precise moment in time when I first heard the term. I keep like trying to search my memory, and I'm hoping that that's going to arise before I finish writing this book. But I remember I always associated that word with taking a bubble bath or going and getting a massage. And it just felt like something that just wasn't attainable for my, you know, early 20s, late teens self. And it felt like something that was unneeded. But obviously that's a pretty big misconception that I had early on when I first heard the word or became familiar with the concept. What do you think is the biggest misconception that people have about self-care?
The biggest misconception I hear over and over again is that self-care is selfish. Mm-hmm. It's self-indulgent. It's and that it's a negative thing. So I think that certainly is what I've heard the most. And I think it's a big misconception, and I've had to, you know, time and time again, try to remind people that, you know, if you're not taking care of yourself, you can't really, there's nothing left to give to others. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't give and expect that there's not going to be any, you know, burnout or whatever you want to call it. But you really, so self-care is not in a pejorative sense. It's not selfish. It's something, it's so necessary. It's necessarily like food and water and all of those things that we need to exist. And I really think that, and maybe just piggybacking on what you said, maybe self-care isn't going to be bubble baths or massages, because they may not be attainable. They may not be affordable or enjoyable for some. But that self-care really has to do with knowing yourself and knowing what, you know, what makes you less anxious, what makes you less stressful.
Yes.
And it's so individual. Yeah. One of the things that I find, and it was one of your questions was, what are some things you can do, or how do I manage stress? One of the things I love to do, is I have a paper shredder, and I love shredding paper. I love shredding old papers and mail and bills that are, you know, have been paid. And just kind of, there's something very therapeutic about it for me.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, and it's not what you would typically think of as self-care, but for me, it's taking that giant stack of papers that have just been piling up and putting them through the shredder in such kind of a brainless way. But it just feels to me, it's very satisfying. And I'd rather do that than get a manicure, probably. You know, so that's, you know, that's my quirk. But, you know, again, everybody is so different. And for some people, things that, and, you know, I see this a lot because I work with the trauma population, not exclusively, but I've been, you know, I was trained in trauma. And so I see a lot of people who have suffered kind of really extreme traumas. And what I have learned through my clinical work is that certain things that might be comforting for people that have not been traumatized are extremely uncomfortable for people that have been.
Yes.
So they actually might, you know, so it's, they might experience something pleasurable, as actually very guilt inducing or bad or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think that's another thing to kind of keep in mind is it's just such a kind of an elusive concept in a way.
It is, yeah. And it's really so important too, to really know yourself, like you're saying, and know your triggers, so you won't get into an activity and then wind up having it be re-traumatizing or bring up unpleasant mm-hmm. memories, or as you're doing it, you know, have the opposite effect. I'm really glad that you brought that up.
Yeah.
You have shared so many terrific strategies and wisdom about self-care, Mary. Is there anything that you wanted to share that you feel like you haven't already said about self-care or stress management or anything else that you feel inclined to talk about?
I don't think too much, but I do. I think that you had asked about intuition, And I think that's such a great question. If I use my intuition, and I would say intuition can be so important in taking care of yourself. And I think it's kind of what I've been talking about the whole time in a way. But really being able to use your intuition, your gut, to make, so you asked before about connections and making connections. Mm-hmm. It can be very good to be vulnerable and get, you know, trust people, but at the same time, you really need to know who to trust. Yes. So you kind of have to have this guiding light in order to know, you know, who to surround yourself with. And I think that's a very intuitive thing. And I think it's in all relationships, we have to be very intuitive about how we relate. And so I wanted to share that. And to really just listen to yourself and try to trust, I guess, trust in yourself more. And again, you may need to do that working in therapy or a group setting or something like that, so you have that kind of support and learning how to do that. But I think it's a really important skill to kind of, and I don't know that it's a skill. Intuition isn't necessarily a skill, but I do think it's important that we listen to our guts.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for reminding me of that question, Mary. I appreciate
that. That's fine.
I'm curious if in your psychoanalytic training, is intuition, is or was that something, was that covered? Was that something that you received formal education or training about, like how to use that in session?
That's such a great question, Eileen. And now I would, my, unless I slept through it, I don't, it's not a term that has been used in my training. What is used, and I think is analogous, or at least as analogous as I can get to, is really the use of more kind of the unconscious communication.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that would be probably the closest thing in my mind to what intuition might be. So really kind of being able to kind of call up those inaccessible channels of communication. So what do they say? And I don't know who says this, but 80% of communication is nonverbal. And yes. I don't know, you know, if those numbers still stand or not. But how does that work? That works through there's some kind of communication going on. So whether that's, we call it intuition or we call it unconscious communication, there's something other than verbal communication that we need to listen to.
Yes. Yeah.
And just as babies are pre-verbal, but are still kind of navigating the world, I think we need to take some of the wisdom back from those babies.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I loved how you say that. You know, I find that so much of sort of the wisdom that I've acquired along the way, which isn't very much, I still have a ways to go.
Don't we all?
But it's really in the unlearning and really the
absolutely
throwing away the false ideas, but, you know, being mindful about it and intentional about it. What,
yes,
sort of things that I learned about when I was younger that I want to keep versus things that I'd rather replace with other thoughts and other beliefs that work better.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's actually another, just as far as, or just from a reference, there's a great article called it's called The Wise Baby by Sandor Ferenczi. I think it's he's a famous trauma theorist. But you know, there is so much to be said for that kind of state before we were able to overthink things and had those kind of basic and get down more to the basics of,
yes,
of, you know, what do babies need? Babies need love. What do people need? People need love. And I know one of the things I'm not good at, and you're probably a lot better at than I am, is one of the breathing techniques. which is basically to breathe more like babies breathe.
Mm-hmm.
As adults, we learn to breathe the wrong way, right?
Yeah.
You can probably speak to that better than I can. I try practicing. It's hard, though. It's hard to unlearn the way of breathing that's not as effective. So I have to practice that. And I,
yes.
Take some tips from you on that.
And you certainly have so many wonderful skills, Mary. And I think that breathing is one of those things. It's interesting. You know, we talk about breathing like a baby. I love how you say that. That's just really illustrates the whole concept really well. You know, breathing from your belly and diaphragmatic mm-hmm. breathing. I find that I actually become bad at breathing quite frequently, and I'm not really quite sure what it is, if it's like the mirror neuron system or if it's, sort of that unconscious, that collective unconscious that we all share. But sometimes I find that my breathing will really tend to mirror sometimes somebody, a client that I'm sitting with or a group or those kinds of things, that I have to really be intentional.
Absolutely.
Something that's easy to do, you know, when I'm with myself or someone that's maybe a nice belly breather, but when I go around other people, I tend to sort of pick up on their habitual patterns as well. It's mm-hmm. something that can be helpful.
That's a great point.
In working with people. Yeah. Mary, thank you so much for all of this tremendous wisdom that you've shared with us today about self-care.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to think about it more. And I think it's so important. It's such an important topic you're writing about, and everybody should learn about it and have access to it.
Yeah. Well, thank you again, Mary. It's great spending time with you.
I know. You too. This is fun.
Please visit www.theinnerpeacediet.com to enroll in Dr. Eileen's free online course. 3 days to a more peaceful life.